It's always the most fun to look at all the wonderful things about us and how great we really are. But to be realistic, we also have to realize that there are some things about us that aren't just quite perfect. Now, from what you already know about the temperaments, you can probably imagine how the different temperaments react to their weaknesses. Now, when the sanguine looks at their weaknesses, how do they feel about them? They're kind of cute little weaknesses. They're rather lovable little weaknesses. Anybody would be happy if that was the worst thing they had to put up with in life, is my weaknesses. Now, that's the way the sanguine looks at it. How does the choleric look at weaknesses? What weaknesses? Right. Perfect. That's just right. What weaknesses? I like that. I have to remember that. How does the melancholy look at weaknesses? They really get into it. Really get into this deeply. Analyze it. Think about it. Some ways rather enjoy them. There's nothing better than a good weakness. And the phlegmatic, they look at the weaknesses and what do they say? Who cares? They're not that bad. And yet each one of us does have a set of weaknesses. It would be wonderful if God had made us all perfect. Well, we think it would be. But again, as I shared this morning, if we were all perfect, there'd be nothing God to do with us that would show what his power was able to accomplish. And because he takes broken, cracked little vessels like you and me and does something with them, because he can do that, that gives us the opportunity to share with others what God can do that we can't do ourselves. And it's been exciting in my life to see how God has taken my husband and me, two strong-willed, arrogant people, and has allowed the circumstances in our life to really bring us to a point where we both realized, independently of each other, that we really weren't as great as we thought we were. That we had actually come up with a double set of circumstances over which we had no control at all. And it was only at that point when we realized that there wasn't anything that we could do in our own power to straighten out our lives, it was only then that we ask that the Lord Jesus come in and do something with us. And I am here today before you as a testimony to the fact that the Lord can take damaged vessels, arrogant ones, conceited ones, self-centered ones, accomplished ones, ones who know how to do everything. He can take people like that who are really of no use to him at all. And he can, by allowing certain circumstances to humble us and to bring us to our knees, he can cleanse us, patch us up, and send us out made ready for his service. And it's amazing how that can happen. So for those of you who are somewhat discouraged over your situation today and problems that you've got, I can tell you from personal experience that God can remake lives. He's done it in our case. He's still doing it. We haven't achieved it. We haven't arrived. He's still working with us. But all he needs out of a vessel is not beauty or brains, but what? Availability. He just needs us to be there, available. When we're available and emptied of ourselves, he can do with us as he will, and to God be the glory. Now, that's why we have some weaknesses. If we were perfect, there'd be nothing for him to work on. And so if you have a lot of weaknesses, you can figure that just gives God that much more space to work in. And he will begin, and he will work on you. Think again, not only of what weaknesses you have, but which ones of these weaknesses are particularly offensive or annoying to other people. As you see some of these, it will come to your mind, the Lord will reveal to you, certain people with whom you deal that have said things to you, such as these charts are saying to you today. And you always thought, well, what does she know? It's his problem, not mine. But you see, today we're going to look at it as it is my problem. There are some areas in my life that aren't right, and I have got to find out what those areas are and openly ask the Lord to work with me in that area. Work at it humanly and spiritually. So as we look, let's start where we left off with the phlegmatic. We'll look that way. And if we start at the end with the phlegmatic and work frontwards, that way if we don't have time, we'll just miss the sanguine weaknesses, and those don't amount to anything anyway. When we look at the phlegmatic, right at the top of the page, on the weakness area, it gives you the top three problems, that they're unenthusiastic, fearful and worried, and indecisive. Now, those are the top three problems. Now, when we look at the phlegmatic in their strengths, we see that the phlegmatic has low-key strengths. So what kind of weaknesses is the phlegmatic going to have? Low-key weaknesses. They're not going to be flagrant weaknesses. They're not going to be the choleric type that when you see them charging forth, you know that they're headed for trouble. They're low-key strengths, and they have comparatively low-key weaknesses. So the first one is that they're unenthusiastic. Now, for those of you who are phlegmatic people and have already decided that you are such nice, easygoing, wonderful, inoffensive people that there couldn't really be anything too much wrong with you, then look at this and ask yourself, how enthusiastic do you ever get about anything? Now, this is one of the most annoying things for people who are living with or working with a phlegmatic, is no matter what they come up with, no matter how excited they are about it, no matter how they present it, what is always the response of the phlegmatic about, would you like to go and do this? What do they say? Yeah, I don't care. Now, see, if you are phlegmatic, you think that that's being agreeable. And you think, how can they get disturbed at me when I'm so agreeable? This is what always happens when I counsel with a phlegmatic. Like a phlegmatic man hasn't said anything in years. And he'll say to me, how can she be upset with me? I haven't even said anything. And I see the phlegmatic somehow feels that that's a virtue, that they kept their mouth shut, and in some cases it may be. But you see, the choleric that's living with this person, when they come up with an idea, what do they want? Some enthusiasm, some response. So for those of you that are phlegmatic, realize this is really a weakness in your life, that you don't get excited or enthused over anything. I talked to one phlegmatic, and I said, why is it you never get enthused? And he sat there, and he thought about it for quite a while, and then he said, frankly, I've never found anything in life yet worth getting enthused about. Now, he's hopeful that someday there might be something. So a young man was dating my daughter. He's about 30 years old. He hasn't yet found anything in life worth getting excited about. Now, after that, my daughter Marita said to me, she said, if he can't even get excited about going out with me, then he sure isn't worth a lot. Now, that's true, because she's something to go out with. And if you can't get excited about her, then really, there's not a lot of hope for him. So that was the last date she had with him. But it's interesting that in his mind, there was nothing wrong with that statement. It was just a true matter of fact. But for those of you who are phlegmatic, realize this is extremely annoying to people that are dealing with you, that you never seem to show any spark of enthusiasm or anything. So work at it. Try. Fake it. And I found out that there's nothing wrong with faking something if it's something you're already supposed to be. Because if you fake it for a while, what might happen to you? It might become genuine. As I tell my son, I said, I would much rather have phony joy than genuine depression. Now, there's nothing wrong with faking a little if it's what you're really supposed to be doing. That's not a lie. It's just putting yourself where God wants you to be and putting a little extra effort on it. And so this is what you phlegmatics should try to do, is to get enthused over something. Now, my mother has never gotten enthused over anything I've ever done, and I've done a lot of things to get enthused over. And after I wrote my first book, I thought, well, this will get her excited. I mean, not everybody's daughter writes a book, so I thought that'll really do it. So I showed her the book, and I told her she was in it, and I thought that'll get at least a smile out of her. No reaction at all. Gave her the book and I watched her read it. You know, sanguines, what is it we want for what we've done? Credit. When everybody say, oh, that's wonderful. So I'm standing there waiting for the great praise that's coming. Didn't even change her expression. And she finished the whole thing, shut the book, never said a word. Now, what's that do to a sanguine? Oh, I was about to go out of my mind here. I was waiting for some kind of comment. So finally I asked my daughter, I said, ask Grammy what she thinks of the book. So Lauren asked her, what do you think of Mother's book? And this is her total statement to this day. Her total statement. Well, it sure is a book. I'm still waiting for something better than that. Nothing. It sure is a book. Now, you see, that's about the best you could say about it. Now, see, this is the phlegmatic lack of enthusiasm over anything. I bought a black dress with chiffon panels. I haven't found anywhere to wear it yet, as a matter of fact. If you're ever going to have a party where you'd like me to enter in a black dress with floating chiffon panels, I've got the thing. I've been waiting. No one's ever invited me to anything that was the right dress for. It's a perfect sanguine dress, but I haven't been able to make an entrance in it yet. So someday you might have something you could ask me to, and I could wear that. So I bought the dress. I brought it home, and my girlfriend, I was showing it to her, and so she looked at my mother, and she said, Florence must look great in this black chiffon dress. She said, in fact, she must look really gorgeous. And my mother thought about it for a second, and she said, well, gorgeous. I'd hardly say gorgeous. Decent, maybe, but surely not carried away with gorgeous. Now, see, this kind of lack of enthusiasm is very difficult for other temperaments to put up with. So if you are a phlegmatic who has no faults that you could mention, maybe you aren't really enthusiastic, and it might help your mate or your children if once in a while you got excited over something. So try for that. The second one on being fearful and worried. My mother, on her 80th birthday, I went to Massachusetts to her home, and we were getting ready to go to church on the morning of her 80th birthday, and we were going to out to church, and there started a big thunderstorm. Thunder, lightning, rain, terrible. But that didn't bother me. I've been to church in the rain before. So we were getting ready, and I looked over, and here's my mother sitting on the edge of the bed looking very worried and fearful. And so I said to her, what's your problem? And she said, well, our church is mostly glass, and there's a thunder and lightning storm, and I'm afraid that I'm going to get killed by lightning in church. Now, being optimistic, I had not thought of the possibility of getting killed in church that morning. Hadn't even passed through my mind. But now here's the phlegmatic sitting there with a fearful, worried look. And so and as you get to know the temperaments, you'll realize how badly we relate one to another. That the phlegmatic is thinking one thing and the sanguine throws out something totally wrong to them. So here is Mother sitting there worried over the whole thing, worried about going to church. And my quick retort, which I certainly regretted later, but as she's sitting there saying, I'm afraid to go to church for fear I'll get killed, I looked at her and I said, what a wonderful way to go, to be struck by lightning in church on one's 80th birthday. Now see, those of you that are sanguine, it's a very clever remark, isn't it? Isn't that cute and adorable, sharp, spontaneous? See how clever I am? Just wonderful. How do you think my mother took that comment? Whew, that was bad. That was bad news. That almost got her so depressed she could hardly get to church at all. And you know that she was so genuinely worried about that, and I'm being flip about it. Ha ha, you know, what a way to go. And after I'd said it, I could have bit my tongue, but I'd already said it by then, because of course sanguine doesn't think a lot first. And then I realized how really genuinely worried she was about the thing, and I had to call up the church and ask them. And I felt kind of dumb when the man picked up the phone, and I said, good morning, are you going to have church this morning? He said, we have church every Sunday morning. That made me feel kind of stupid right there. And then I said, well, my mother was, you know, kind of nodding at me. So I said, well, what I meant was because of the rain. And he said, well, we have church even when it rains. And you see how poles apart we were. I mean, here's my mother really wanting me to call up to see if the church is going to have church when it rains because she might get killed by lightning. And I'm thinking, this has got to be the most ridiculous thing I'm doing. Now, do you see how incompatible people are of different temperaments? Sometimes people say to me, what temperaments should marry each other? The answer is nobody should marry anybody. There's no hope for any of us. They're just taken in our sinful, rotten natures, looking to our own devices. And there's no way any of us going to get along with anybody. We aren't made to get along with anybody when we're functioning just in our own way. But when we do become aware of these weaknesses and see the areas in our lives that are wrong and that are offensive, even if they don't bother us, but things that bother other people. See, when we become aware of these, which is the first step, and check them off and look at them in print, then we can bring these to the Lord and say, Lord, I can't do this, but I'm asking you to help me. I'm asking you to do this for me, to work with me. And then don't just sit back and let him work, but get to work yourself with him so that the two of you together, yoked together, the Bible tells us we are yoked together, both of us linked together, the Lord Jesus and I, and he's going to go along with me, he's going to help me, and he's going to speak for me. And the more I submit to him and the more I allow him to work through me, the less of my human nature is going to show, and the less of my weaknesses and faults are going to be glaring out there, bothering other people. I know it works. I've seen it happen. And as I tell my husband that the changes in him have been more drastic, but that's because he was worse than I was to start with. But we have both worked. We have both taken these temperaments for the last 12 years, laid them before the Lord, worked on them ourselves, encouraged each other in improving in these areas, and have seen such amazing changes. The next one is that they are indecisive. Now, this does not mean that the phlegmatic cannot make a decision. It does not mean that the phlegmatic is not intelligent enough to make a decision at all, in no way. What it means is that the phlegmatic has made one major decision in life, and that is to never make any decisions. Now, what is it that they are spared in life if they never make decisions? Responsibility of something going wrong. And the phlegmatic, as it says in the next one, avoids responsibility, because if you take a stand and are responsible and it goes wrong, you have to accept the responsibility. And the phlegmatic does not want that kind of burden. So consequently, they tend to give over the responsibility to other people. Now, should you be married to a phlegmatic husband? He decided a long while ago that it was much easier to let you make all the decisions and be wrong. And then he could say to you what? I told you so. You aren't smart enough to do this. You are a dummy. There's no way you're going to make it. You can't handle this house. You can't run anything. You're hopeless. There's not much good in you. Now, he can say that because he hasn't had to take the rap for it. He's put you in that kind of a position. Now, you see, when I'm talking with men, I tell them how they've got to get out of that. And if you're a phlegmatic, since that's what we're talking to today, is those of you that are here, if you're a phlegmatic, realize that the reason you put all the responsibility on other people and never take any stand in life or become in charge of anything, even your own family or your own life, is because if you don't take any stand, you don't have to back up and be responsible. And most phlegmatics don't want to be responsible. But you see, that's a definite weakness in your life. So begin to practice taking responsibility and making decisions. Some of you might start start with simple things like coffee or tea, something like that where you can make a decision. Now, you already know enough about the temperaments that you can probably give me the answers to this. If a choleric, let's say a choleric woman, for example, is going to pour a cup of coffee or tea, and they're standing there with a pot of boiling water, and they say to the phlegmatic husband, "Do you want coffee or tea?" What is his response? "I don't care." All right, now that's the response. See, you can give it right back in unison. You see, you'll get so used to this after a while that you'll think this way, which will help you to understand people. So you're standing there with a pot of hot water, and you're asking, "Do you want coffee or tea?" And he says, "I don't care." Now, when a choleric asks, "Do you want coffee or tea?" What do they want to know? They want an answer. Do you want coffee or tea? If the choleric only had coffee, what would they ask you? Do you want a cup of coffee? They would not make a mistake. I mean, if they didn't have both, they wouldn't ask you for both. They're able to provide you with either one, and they're asking you, which one do you want? They want a decision. Now, what does the phlegmatic think? I've talked to people about this. What does the phlegmatic think they are doing when they're saying, "I don't care"? Being agreeable and pleasant and nice and inoffensive and causing no trouble. That's the way they feel. All right, now, for all of you who fit that bill, right there, realize that while you think you are being sweet, nice, pleasant, inoffensive by saying, "I don't care, it doesn't matter, whatever you've got, whatever you have the most of, it doesn't really make any difference." For those of you that say things like that, you are not being pleasant, cooperative, and inoffensive. You are aggravating the rest of us. Now, see, once you understand that, you will begin to come up with some concrete answers. And this is very important for every other temperament. So realize that. It's so important. Now, the quiet will of iron. This is one that when I was first doing this, I didn't realize the phlegmatic had this. I thought the phlegmatic was so agreeable and pleasant that they never really bucked anybody at all. But as I began to study this and think about it, I realized that underneath this placid, easygoing exterior is hidden away a quiet will of iron. Now, when the choleric does not like something, what do they do about it? Tell you right off. They let you know. "That's wrong. I don't like it. We're not going to do it. Forget it. Get out of here." Whatever it may be, they tell you right off. You never have to worry where you stand with the choleric. They've already told you. Now, when the phlegmatic doesn't like it, what do? They keep quiet about it, and they just store it up inside here. It goes like this. Let's say the choleric woman says to her phlegmatic husband on Sunday, she says, "Harry, we're going to go to Sally's house Saturday night for dinner." And Harry, being phlegmatic, gives the typical phlegmatic answer when she says that, which is, "No." Now, from what you know already, when a choleric makes a statement, if you say anything short of "absolutely not," what does it mean? Yes. All right, does he understand that now? When you're dealing with a choleric, when a choleric is dealing with someone, if you do not say "absolutely not," the choleric takes it as yes. Because what do they already know about what they're telling you? It's right. They know it's right. So because they know it's right, they don't really need your answer. See, now once you understand that, it's easier to deal with them. So the choleric says, "We're going to go to Sally's house Saturday night." And the phlegmatic says, "Nah." Now that means yes to the choleric. Didn't mean yes from the phlegmatic, but it meant yes to the choleric. So every day that week, "Remember, Harry, Saturday night, Sally's house for dinner." Nah. Whole week goes on this way. Saturday night comes, she goes in, gets dressed up, comes out all ready. He's sitting in front of the TV in his T-shirt. She looks at him and she says, "Why aren't you dressed?" "We're going to Sally's house for dinner." And he says his first complete sentence of the week, which is, "I'm not going to Sally's house." Now what's the choleric do then? Screams, explodes. And what do they say? "What do you mean we're not going to Sally's house for dinner? I've been telling you all week we were going." He'll say, "I never said I was going." Then she says, "You never said you weren't." "But I never said I was. And I'm not." Now, once the phlegmatic has made his only statement of the week, what chance is there that you will change his mind? None at all. Now, you're beginning to understand how you deal this way with other people. You see, you can almost predict the responses on certain areas once you understand the temperament. So they have that quiet will of iron. The phlegmatic is selfish. They're not going to get up out of the chair and do anything for you. They're just going to sit there and let you muddle around by yourself. They're too shy and reticent. They're kind of holding back. They're not going to go out and exert themselves. They're too compromising. "We'll do anything you say as long as it'll keep you quiet. And let's just not fight about it. I don't care where we go. I don't care what we do. I mean, you can go. You can take them all. You can go jump off a bridge. I don't care what you do. Just leave me alone and make any difference." That's the way phlegmatic thinks. They're self-righteous. They sit around. They say, "I'm sure glad I'm not noisy like the sanguine talking all the time. I'm glad I'm not bossy like the choleric. I'm glad I'm not depressed like the melancholy. I'm glad I'm good like me." Now, that's the way that the phlegmatic thinks about themselves. And now, at work, they're not goal-oriented, and you need to really help them establish some kinds of goals. They need to get something laid out for them. They lack self-motivation. They're hard to get moving. And one of the worst things is that while they're hard to get moving, once you do get them up out of the chair and wind them up like a little toy and send them off in some direction, once you do that, what do they feel about it? they resent being pushed. They won't get up till you get them up, but once you get them up, they resent the fact. And they say, why didn't you leave me alone? I would have gotten up by myself. But you know by experience, if you left them there, they would rot in that chair before they would ever get up and do anything at all. So you see, they resent being pushed. They're lazy and careless. One lady told me her husband always calls information because he feels that's what they're there for, and why should he lift up the book? Easier to dial information. They discourage others, and they'd really rather watch. Now, as a friend, they dampen your enthusiasm. Everybody gets together. We're all going to go take all of our little kids to Disneyland. Isn't that going to be fun? Won't we have a great time? What's the phlegmatic say? I don't really think I want to go to that. That sounds like we might lose the kids, and it's going to be too much work, and it sounds terrible to me. And you go ahead, but just count me out. I don't want any part of that. You see, they dampen the enthusiasm of others. They stay uninvolved. They don't want to be in charge of anything. They don't want to make the calls. They don't want to do the follow-up. Just leave me alone. Leave me out of it. Leave me right here where I am. They're not very exciting. Now, the phlegmatic's easygoing and nice to get along with, but you would never choose the phlegmatic to get everything all excited at a high pitch, because the phlegmatics just don't get very excited. One girl told me, she said, living with my phlegmatic husband, she says, I feel like a talk show host. She says, every night he comes home and we sit down at dinner and I look at him and he sits there quietly and I say to him, and what's your name, honey? And where do you work? And what do you do? And so you got to really pull it out of them. And she said, when I work hard like that, I maybe get 2 or 3 sentences a night if I'm lucky. And I see they really need to be pulled out on their own. They're not exciting. They're indifferent to the plans of others, and they're always judging other people because they've got a lot of time on their hands to do that. And they're sarcastic and teasing. When they do talk, their humor tends to be sarcastic, and they resist change. One phlegmatic man I counseled told me, he said, I'd rather leave my marriage the way it is and pretend it's all right because change might be worse. Now, I thought that was such a perfect phlegmatic statement. It's bad. I mean, it's a real bad situation here, but I'd rather leave it the way it is. At least I understand it, because change might be worse. Now, when you look at this, you see here, the phlegmatic on the strength side is that they're easygoing and natural and down-to-earth and can be pleasant to be with and are inoffensive. But on the negative side, the same kind of weaknesses as their strengths, in that they have these low-key weaknesses where they don't really get moving, they're not too excitable, don't have any enthusiasm, don't want to make any decisions, don't want to be responsible, don't want to get up and get going in life. So when you look at this, you see here a person that has many beautiful strengths, but many very subtle and quiet weaknesses. Now, the best kind of person in the world would be a motivated phlegmatic. If you could get a phlegmatic that had all the strengths of the phlegmatic and was also motivated to some kind of action and responsibility, you would have a perfect person. So as you think about that, those of you that are phlegmatics, realize that if you got up out of the chair, got moving, got excited, got turned on about something, you see, you could be as close to a perfect person as the world will ever know. So why don't you head in that direction? All right, let's look at the melancholy. As we look at the melancholy weaknesses, melancholies like their weaknesses. They get kind of interested in them, like to study them and think about them and brood over them. Because the melancholies, as you see right at the top, they remember the negatives, and they like negative thinking. And as my son Freddie, the only times he gets really excited is when something tragic happens. He loves it when there's a real good accident, and there's something really that's very negative. Because that's where the melancholy tends to respond to the negative things in life. My husband remembers many of the things that went wrong in his childhood. And the time that I had all of that music ministry together, I asked them about remembering the negatives, since I'd never had so many melancholies in one room before for a full day. You can imagine that was somewhat depressing by the time I was through that day. And as I had all this group together, and I asked them something about, could they remember back in their childhood? In fact, I said, let's make it specific. In your first 1 or 2 grades that you went, how many of you can remember something that the teacher said that really did you in? And all their hands went up. They all went up. They could all remember this. So we went around the room and had them give different little things. It was amazing how those melancholies would stand up and they would really get into this. And they would remember what the teacher wore, how she looked, where she was standing, what she did, and how they were done in. Now you see, the melancholy has a marvelous resource for remembering the negative things of life. That's just part of their nature. Now, if you're living with that kind of a person who is constantly remembering the negative, how much fun is that? You mentioned something that you'd like to do. Let's all go to a certain place. What does the melancholy immediately refresh your memory about? The last time we went there, you remember we lost all the children. Remember?
certainly don't want to go there again. How about if we do this? Your mother brought this up. Oh, my mother. When she brings it up, you can know it's not going to work out. That'll never do. They remember all the negative things that other people have done in life. And this is not a very positive experience to live with. They tend to be moody and depressed. And again, I've talked to many of you since we've gotten together here about depression. The melancholy has a built-in ability to become depressed. I mean, that's part of their nature, and that's natural with them. So when you realize this, the melancholy very easily becomes depressed. They get depressed if someone says anything that hurts them. They're always looking at it as if you are out to get them, and they drop easily into a gloom. And many times, the melancholy, who is not as strong verbally as the choleric, will manipulate people in the family by their moods. And I have one daughter that tends to do this. She doesn't think she does this, and hope she doesn't listen to this tape, but she gets upset if the family plans for all of us don't go the way she wants them to go. And when it's time for these plans to go, and my husband, who's choleric enough to just step in and say what's going to happen, if it goes a different way, what happens to the expression on her face? It's just like a black curtain is dropped between us. Now, see, so what do the rest of us then tend to do? We tend to avoid causing this. Now, what does that really mean? What kind of control does she have there? Now, see, I'm just mentioning one, and this is not a real bad problem with her, but I'm giving you this as a personal example, you see, because it's close to my heart. When you have one person who doesn't yell and stamp and scream and tell you off, but who, when things don't go the way that she has already pre-programmed, and you know that the melancholy pre-plans everything, then there is this gloom. So therefore, all of us in the family tend to think ahead, what will bother her? And then we avoid doing that. Now, you see what that means really is that the melancholy manipulates the actions of the rest of the family by their moods. Now, those of you who are melancholy, think about it. How often do people change their plans because you dropped at the very thought of a certain thing? You see, many of the melancholies become easily depressed, easily moody, and they have learned that this is a good tool to use to get everyone else to do what they want, and yet they can stand there self-righteous and say, well, I'm not like the choleric who tells everybody what to do. I didn't say a word. And they didn't say a word. But when you saw that gloom drop over them, you knew you'd gone in the wrong direction. And if you want to keep peace, you pull right off and you try to do it their way. They see the melancholy manipulates in a quiet way. And they are definite manipulators, but much more subtle than the choleric who just tells you where to go and what to do. So those of you who are melancholy realize that this is not a positive trait. And while you may be able to work people around this way and manipulate them, are they so stupid they don't know that? No, they're sitting back saying, well, she's the one, she's the touchy one. If we're going to do this certain thing, we better make sure that it won't offend her. Because if we get her offended before we go on this little trip, what kind of a trip are we all going to have with her? Terrible. And since we're going to have to take her with us. Now, see, a lot of you melancholies get left home a lot. And you get left out of things a lot. And then you sit home and get depressed and say, nobody ever asked me. Do you know why nobody ever asked you? Because they took you once. And one day of this gloom was all I could handle. And the next time they got ready to go, they say, well, let's leave her out. Because you remember, she's the kiss of death. I mean, you take her along, it's going to be just doom for the day. Now, see, if you are a melancholy, realize this. I've had some melancholy women who are elderly, and they say to me, nobody ever comes to see me. They'll complain, my children never come to see me, never write to me, never call me, never anything. And then I ask them in the conversation, the last time your son came to see you, what did you talk about? Well, I told him, nobody ever comes to see me. Now, see, if you came to see somebody and they told you that nobody ever comes to see them, how does that make you feel? Because you didn't come for 6 months anyway. How do you feel by the time you left? Guilty. When you feel guilty and you know that if you go again, you're going to feel guilty again, what do you tend not to do? You don't want to go to that person because they make you feel guilty. And I see, if you are melancholy, think about this. How often do you manipulate? How often do you make people feel guilty? How often when they do show up, do you point out to them they haven't come for a long time or they should have done this? How often, I have one relative, and when her son comes to visit her, she has a huge list. Now, he's married, but when he comes to visit her, she has a big list of household repairs he's got to do. And if he doesn't do them all, how does she make him feel? Guilty. And so, therefore, when he thinks of spending a Sunday afternoon somewhere, where does he decide not to go? To see her. Now, do you understand what the melancholy tends to do? Now, those of you who are melancholy, realize this, that this is not the way to go. Nobody wants to spend time with someone who makes them feel guilty, who enumerates their negatives, who tells them what's wrong with them, or who drops into a gloom if things don't go their way. Now, see, all of these traits, for the marvelous melancholy with all their temperament strengths, that when they drop into these type of negatives, people tend to stay away from them. And some of you, I've talked with several of you today, that have a mate that is in this kind of a situation, that people are avoiding him. Now, we can't do anything about him. He's not here. But those of you who are melancholy that are here, sincerely think about this. Do you make it unpleasant for those who do show up? Do you cause gloom to fall upon certain groups? Sometimes the melancholy manipulates by what they feel are positive traits, such as, don't worry about me. I'll just stay here and watch out for the children or whatever. And you all go and you just have a good time. Now, in their mind, what are they being to you? Gracious, generous with their time for you. But by the time you have walked out the door, how do you already feel? Depressed and guilty. Now, you see, the melancholy is so able to put the guilt and the depression onto other people. And they can even do it with sort of a smile. In fact, they sometimes do have sort of a smile because they love to see what they can do with you. And you see, there's this little manipulative skill there that is very unpleasant for the other people to bear. So try to remember that, melancholies, and don't use this ability you have because it is a negative. The melancholy enjoys being hurt. Now this, if you're not a melancholy, it's hard to understand this, and took me a while. If I hadn't lived with Fred, I wouldn't believe this. But I have seen how he loves to be able to prove that I've hurt him. And if he can come up with great proof on this, which he usually can because I'm good at it, he can prove that everybody's against him and that life is awful and that here he is, happily hurt. When he was a teenager, they used to have company at his house every Sunday, and the young children of the family always wanted the end cuts of the roast beef, that where all the spices were, really nice. And so they always wanted that. And so my husband noticed, as he sat there Sunday after Sunday, that he did not seem to be getting his fair share of the end cuts of the roast beef. So he began to keep a chart on it. And he made a chart of all the different dates and what people got the end cuts. Now, he made out this roast beef chart for 16 weeks. At the end of that time, his mother found it under the blotter on his desk, and she, when he came home from school, she said to him, "What is this chart with all these names and dates?" And as he would tell it to you if he were here, he would say, "I was so happy to be able to explain to her that that is the roast beef chart for who gets the end cuts." And in the 16 weeks that he kept the chart, how many times do you think he got the end cut of the roast beef? Zero. Was he hurt? Did he have reason to be hurt and upset? He was thrilled that he could prove how hurt he really was. The melancholy enjoys being hurt. The melancholy has a false humility. By this I mean, the melancholy says things such as, "I really never know how to dress. My hair never comes out right. I never know what to say at the right time. No matter what I put on, I don't feel right in it. When I get to parties, I look around and I know I'm the only one who doesn't really have the right feel for the thing. I never really can cook right. When I set the table, it never looks too good. My food doesn't taste right. I try the recipe and it was good at her house, but when I do it, it's just terrible." Now, this kind of thing is constant patter for the melancholy. And what does the melancholy feel they are telling you when they say these things? What do they feel they're communicating? That they are what? Humble. They are humble people. Certainly they are not conceited. They don't have any ego. They are definitely humble. Now, what are they actually forcing you into doing? Complimenting them. They are making you stand there and say, your hair is lovely, you do look good, you do know how to dress, you can cook well, we do want you to come. Oh, please do come. Underneath you're saying, I hope she stays home. And this is what you're forcing other people to do. You're forcing them to compliment you. And what does it show about your nature? What do people see? That how do you feel about yourself? That you're very insecure. You are very, very insecure. And that's why you're saying, I am not good in this, I'm not good at that, I don't look good here, and so forth. I had one friend, every time I went to pick her up, she would say, oh, I look terrible today, my hair didn't come out right, my makeup is wrong, my dress doesn't look good, and if you see anybody you know, just don't even mention that I'm with you. Now, she would say this all the time. Years she said this to me every time I picked her up. One day I got sick of it, and when she told me that, which was her usual routine in the morning, and she was a gorgeous girl, I mean, absolutely beautiful. And so when I picked her up this one day, I said to her, you're right, your hair does look terrible, your makeup's a mess, and if I meet anybody today that I know, please stay in the background, don't let them know I'm with you. Now, that wasn't too nice of me to do, but it did cure her. With me. Now, I don't know what she did with others, but she has never approached me with that again. Now, you see, many melancholies think this is their marvelous humility, their low spirit, their absence of self. But what it really is it signals to everybody else, here is an insecure person who needs me to constantly pick her up out of the ditch, wind her up, and tell her she's wonderful. Now, you see, when you understand what it is that you're exhibiting, perhaps the next time you begin to say that, you'll stop. And instead of saying, I'm no good, in me is no good thing, I can't accomplish a thing, that you'll keep quiet about it and let other people see what you can do and let them compliment you naturally instead of forcing it out of them. So remember that. That's the false humility. Many times the melancholy is off in another world, kind of in a trance. They have low self-image, have selective hearing. You can say 42 lovely things to them and one bad one, and what's all I remember? One bad one. Don't remember anything good you said. Self-centered. Now, this is not in the ego way of the sanguine up front making everybody look at them, but self-centered in that they are always looking at everything as to how does it relate to me. They're too introspective, constantly analyzing themselves and everybody else. They've got a lot of guilt feelings themselves, which is why they put it on others also. They have persecution complex. Everybody's against me. Everybody's out to get me. See, they're whispering about me. Now, if sanguine's in one corner and a melancholy's in another corner, and there's a group whispering in the middle, what does the melancholy think? Melancholy says, oh dear, they're talking about me. I wonder what's wrong with me now. I begin to look, see if the slip is showing, run in the stocking. They immediately know something's negatively wrong with them. Now, if the sanguine looks over and sees them all whispering, what's the sanguine say? Oh boy, they're talking about me. See, the sanguine doesn't even care what you say as long as it's about them. When you give a compliment to a melancholy, how do they take it? They take it as an insult. You say, your hair looks wonderful today. What was wrong with it yesterday? You say the nicest thing to a melancholy and make it negative. You can insult a sanguine, and what do? Take it like a compliment. Oh, thank you. That's wonderful. They're so excited. You see the difference in the temperaments. It shows in even giving a compliment. They tend to hypochondria. In the extreme, when a melancholy becomes very depressed, they tend to become hypochondriacs. But the good thing about that is at least they organize their pill bottles in the medicine chest, all the A's and the B's, so it'll be all put together. And as workers, the melancholies, since they are not people-oriented, are not good up front. They are not good out where they have to deal with the public. They're much better back in the type of thing where they're doing the research or counting the money or adding up the columns or whatever it may be in that particular area. They get depressed over imperfections, and mainly other people's imperfections, because other people never do it right. They choose difficult work because they constantly want challenges. Innately, the melancholy wants to fail. Innately, underneath, they want to fail. And so they consequently often choose things that are too hard for them, so that they then can fail and then satisfy themselves that they couldn't do what they knew they couldn't do in the first place. Now, that's an extreme melancholy. I'm sure none of you are that extreme. But sometimes an extreme melancholy will have that problem. They're hesitant to start projects, and they spend too much in the planning, and they prefer the analysis to the work. Now, for example, if I want a picture hung in my house, and I ask my melancholy husband to hang the picture, I already know I'm in for trouble. Because what's the first problem when he goes to hang the picture? Before he hangs it, what has he got to do? Measure. See now how you all know this now? You have to measure. The melancholy must measure. Now, since he's living with a sanguine, what's always missing? The measuring tape. We haven't got any idea where it is. Now, there is a certain place for it, but chances are it's not there because somebody used it and we never did remember to put it back. My husband bought a desk just recently that has a lock on it. And he told me one day, for 28 years, I have never been able to put my hands on the scotch tape. And he said, from now on, this is locked and no one is getting in here. Now, that's the only desk in the house that we know, if we could get into it, which we can't, we know we could find scissors and tape and rulers and pens and pencils. We could find everything we wanted in there if we could get into it. Now, why can't we get into it any longer? Because for 28 years, we've all abused the privilege. And he wants to open that drawer and see everything in the categories the way he left it. And so when he can't find it that way, you see, he's now got it all locked up. And now the rest of us can never find scissors, tape, or anything like that again. I know when he's going to hang a picture, he's got to first measure it. Now, assuming he does find the tape and does begin to measure it, every house we've been in has crooked walls. You go to measure them, the walls aren't even. Now, what does that do to a melancholy when he finds out he just paid $150,000 for a house and the walls are crooked? Instant depression. Right there. Now, that's enough to do him in and hesitate right there. We'll never get the picture up now. He's not going to hang a picture on a crooked wall. Now, even if he decides he will, and he does measure, and he does find the place to put the picture, even if he does that, then what's the next thing he needs? Certain kind of a nail. Now, see, I didn't know that nails came in kinds. I just thought nails were nails. To me, nails are all about that big and about as fat as my finger. I mean, that's a nail. I mean, a real nail. But I found out that you have to have certain size nails for certain weight pictures. Now, I didn't know that before I got married. And you have to have certain kind of things that have hooks on them. And then you need what are called molly bolts. Now, I never heard of them before either. They're things that go in the plaster, and then and when they get inside, they all spread out. You know, that kind of thing. You have to have those for plastered walls. Now, I don't have to have those for plastered walls, but Fred does. Fred needs those. And he has to have those so that they'll be secure. Now, I don't care. We're not going to live there too long anyway. The thing will probably hold. But he wants it so it's going to be there until the house burns down. And so we got to have the right kind of bolts. Do we ever have those when he's ready to... So he feels that when he moves... It's a real sanguine crowd here. When he feels that when we made that move, then he had to plaster about 6 times as many holes as he really should have had to do. Yeah, yeah. So you see, this is the difference in our temperaments. So many times the melancholy wants to spend a lot of time getting ready for it while the rest of us just do it. The melancholy is self-deprecating. You won't like me. You won't like my food. You won't want to come. My house isn't big enough. I don't have matching china. I don't have goblets. You won't like anything I've got. And constantly saying what's wrong with them, which makes people a little disturbed after a while. Their standards are often too high. Had one lady come up to me after a conference like this, and she said, now I see what's the problem in my family. She said, I didn't understand anything about temperaments before. And she said, I've got this one peculiar son. And she said, the rest of us seem to function normally. Now, you see, melancholies always think that the norm is what? The way they think. Because they've thought it out a lot more than you have. And they've planned out life a lot better. So therefore, if they've thought it out and you're just winging it through life, naturally, they are more right than you are. And so consequently, she said to me, my husband is a melancholy, I'm a melancholy, he's a doctor, and he can't find any nurse to work for him that does it right. So she said, I have to work for him because I'm the only one who can sense what is right the way he wants it. So we work together. And then she said, but I have to have a housekeeper then at home. And she says, my housekeeper at home doesn't do anything right. So when I come home from the day's work, what do I have to do? Redo all the housework to make it right. My oldest son, he agrees with me. He does things right, the way my husband and I do. So the three of us all are right. But I have this peculiar son. Now, you see, she never knew about temperaments before. She had actually called the psychiatrist when I sent the kid away to him. And she said, this peculiar son, she said, I have in my house, she said, I do things right. I lay out the magazines on the coffee table, and I leave 2 inches around the edge of the magazines. And I put each one down, and I lay it down, and the next one goes just under the title of that one, and they go in sequence. And I put out this week's magazines on the coffee table. We can't touch those. We read last week's.
and we put the new ones out on the table, and we read the ones that we take off the table, because we can't read them the week they're laid out, because they might get wrinkled, and they must look good. And then the books, we take off the book jackets if we read. Of course, probably better if we didn't, because then they won't take any chances of getting ripped. And so we read them with the jackets off, and she went on and on telling me how right she does everything at home. But she said, I have this peculiar son. And she said, just last week, and she could see her get furious when she told me this, she said, just last week, I was standing there in the living room, he walked in, took one look at me, and he swept all the magazines off onto the floor, picked one up, ripped off the cover, and threw it at my feet. She said, isn't that a peculiar son? Now, surely someone who does that should go to a psychiatrist. Now, what was the problem with this poor son? He wasn't a melancholy. And the standards were so high that the poor fellow couldn't take it any longer. And just one day, he had it as much as he could take with these even magazines that you couldn't touch, and he just swept them off the table. So as we talked about it, she said, now I can see that it's not that he's peculiar, he's just not a melancholy like the rest of us in the family. And I see how important it is to understand the temperament so that you don't try to put everybody else in life into a mold with you and try to make them just the way you think and to behave just like you. That same lady also had kept a file box on all of her the people she'd entertained in 14 years. And she had a double cross-reference in two files of all the people that she'd had. And then over here, the parties with the list of all the people. And on your particular card, would have down if there was any comment about the food that you did or didn't like, so that the next time she had you, she could look up and see if you didn't like onions. And this was on a file card. And then at the bottom of each one of your cards, she had whether or not you'd set a thank you note each time that she'd had you over. Now, isn't that interesting? I mean, and here was a perfect lady. She gorgeous-looking thing, put together just right, doing everything perfectly in life. Now, you see, she did everything so perfectly. What was she unable to see? That any of this could be a negative because she was so perfect. And I see a lot of melancholies have set themselves up. They know they're doing the right thing. They've analyzed it, thought about it, figured it out, and they're doing it right. And therefore, if you differ from them, what has to be your problem? You are wrong. And I see melancholies, think about that, because that's so important. You can be right, and you could have planned it all out, but it doesn't necessarily make everybody enjoy being with you. All right, let's look at the friend. Melancholy is a friend. They tend to live through other people. Several of you have commented to me today how certain types of people are attracted to you. And it is interesting that in life, different temperaments do attract each other for different reasons. And many times the melancholy, and this is sometimes a talent, that they are able to become someone else. They are able to live through someone else. This is why most of your good character actors are melancholies, because they are able to put their thinking into the body or the sense, the self of another person. And they're able to become someone else. Someone that, such as Hal Holbrook, when he did Mark Twain and so forth, where it said he spent several years absorbing the life of Mark Twain, listening to voice recordings of him, looking at pictures of him, everything, so he could become Mark Twain. And he was able to do it and be convincing. Now, the reason he was able to do that is because he has a melancholy nature that is able to put themselves into someone else's position. Now, that's the good part of it. The negative part of it is that melancholies tend to, instead of making a life and a personality of their own, they tend to latch onto a sanguine choleric type of person and live through them. Now, I've had this happen to me so many times in my life where I've had a deeply melancholy person attach themselves to me, many times even move into my house. I've had many people live with me, and most of them are melancholies who have attached themselves to me and somehow found it easier to live their fun life through me than to make one of their own. And this can be a negative problem. And so those of you that are melancholies, are you living through some sanguine friend? Are you making them your life? And what usually happens to a melancholy who attaches themselves to some outgoing person and lives through them and goes with them and travels with them and becomes them, they are so slavishly devoted to this person that they almost begin to drain some of the life out of this other person. And after a while, the other person has to look and decide, is their slavish devotion worth the fact that I have them clinging to me day after day after day? And I've had to make that decision several times. And I've had to divest myself of someone who was a devoted and faithful friend because they couldn't live without me. And when you're in the position of the one who's being drained, sometimes after years of this, you just can't take it any longer. So think about that, melancholies. Do you attach yourself to some outgoing person and siphon the lifeblood right away from them?
And if you do, let them function a little by themselves. Don't have to be everywhere they are. Don't cling to them all the time. Don't need their decision for everything. Let them live, and they'll be much happier and a longer friend if you let them live and are with them part of the time, but don't have to grab onto them all the time. And I find this to be such a problem with melancholies. I want to make sure that you think about that in your own life. They tend to be insecure socially, withdrawn, remote. They're critical of other people. They hold back affection. They dislike those that are in opposition. They're suspicious of other people, always looking for someone to be doing them in or talking about them. Antagonistic and vengeful, sometimes unforgiving because they have such a memory of the wrongs. They're full of contradictions. They'll be positive one day and negative the next, and they're very skeptical of compliments. Now, again, that will give you plenty to work on, and as we've seen that the phlegmatic has low-key strengths and low-key weaknesses, what kind of strengths and weaknesses does the melancholy have? They have what kind of strengths? Deep strengths and deep weaknesses. You see, the melancholy is the greatest and the worst. They are the two extremes. You remember in the beginning of the Tale of Two Cities where Dickens says, these were the best of times and the worst of times. The best for some and the worst for others. Well, with the melancholy, they are the best of people when they're turned on and the worst of people when they're turned off. They are the extremes, the very highest of the best and the very lowest of the worst. And there is very little middle road with the melancholy. So those of you who are melancholies, you need, absolutely need, beyond a shadow of a doubt, to have a vital relationship with the Lord that will keep you on the positive side, where he can uphold you and uplift you and keep your mind thinking in a positive direction. Because while you have deep strengths, you also have comparative deep weaknesses. Now, in the choleric, what kind of strengths does the choleric have? Strong, loud strengths. So therefore, what kind of weaknesses is the choleric going to have? Strong, loud weaknesses. Now, you see, we have the same in each kind, the same kind of strengths as we have weaknesses. Now, when you look at the choleric, you see right off at the top there the obvious weaknesses, that they're bossy and impatient. Now, the choleric does not feel that he's being bossy. What does the choleric feel that he's doing when he's telling everybody what to do? He's helping them, right? Helping them, because what are they without him? Incompetent and lost, right? You see, without their leadership, you couldn't make it. And because you can't make it without them, what have they got to do? Tell you how to do everything. Now, see, that's the way the choleric feels. When you begin to understand this, then you're much more able to put up with it. You realize they're not out trying to be bossy. This is their nature. And the best way to learn to get along with a choleric is to do what? Do exactly what they say to do when they say to do it. Now, it's not easy. You end up with no personality. But it is the way to get along, because that's the way they've said it. Thus saith the choleric. Now, they do tell everybody what to do. It's their innate nature. They see what should be done, and they tell you. They tell you, this is the way it should go. This is what we better do. Let's get moving. Let's all go. Let's get up. Let's move on. And they tell you these things. It's only natural for them to say this. This is the way they think, and this is it. And on they go. Now, most cholerics do not see that this is a problem. They don't even think they have any weaknesses. And I have to be a little bit harder on the choleric than any other one, because they really don't see that there's anything wrong with them. And I had one man come up one night, and carrying the paper in his hand, he marched up to me, and only cholerics come up to tell the speaker what was wrong with them. Melancholies think about it and get depressed over it. Sanguines don't care, and phlegmatics don't care, really. But the choleric comes up and tells you. Sanguine comes up and gives you extra stories to help you out, because you haven't got enough. But the choleric comes up to straighten you out. And this one man came up, and as he marched up, he said to me, I have all of the strengths and none of the weaknesses. And right behind him, a little phlegmatic wife, and she's going... She has learned to never open her mouth in opposition to get belted. So she's quiet about it, but she's letting me know by just this little turn of the head, that's not true. And then he comes up and he says, furthermore, these things aren't even weaknesses. I said, they aren't? He said, no. He said, now take impatience. He said, impatience is not a problem with me. He said, I would never get impatient. If only the dummies would do it, I told them to do it the time I told them to do it. He said, impatience is not a problem with me. This is his quote. Impatience is not a problem with me. It's a fault in others. Now, you see, only a choleric could even make that statement. See how perfect that is for the choleric? Impatience is not a problem with me. It is a fault in other people. Because if they did what I told them to do, what I told them to do it, we would never have any problem at all. Now, isn't that interesting how the choleric thinks?
There is nothing wrong with them. It's those other people that are mixed up that cause the problem. I had one lady, I asked her if she'd be chairman of something. She's a caller. And she said to me, I'll be glad to be chairman as long as I don't have to have a committee with people. She was able to do what? She would do the job and she would do it right as long as she didn't get encumbered and held down by a committee. Now I asked a phlegmatic woman if she'd be chairman. She said, I'll be glad to be chairman, but do I have to do anything? Now see the difference in thinking? You spot their temperaments right off when you ask them to be chairman of something. The sanguine will say, oh, does that mean I stand up front? And they want to be that. So you see, we all have different reactions, even to the same question. After a while, you'll be able to hear those. Quick-tempered. The choleric is quick-tempered. Everything is quick about the choleric. It's going to be now, it's going to be right, it's going to be this way, it's going to be my way, and if not, I'll kick you. It's that simple. Now, children learn pretty fast from a choleric parent, and they stay out of their way usually, run away from home at an early age. The choleric can't relax. Now this, my husband and I have learned this in our own lives. And since we're both half choleric, and we seem to be getting more choleric in our old age, and less sanguine and melancholy, we're coming to the clashing middle road here. And as we do this, we found out that it's true that we really don't relax very well. We both are supercharged. We both are always doing things. We're always heading off in our own way. I'm just realizing it's picking up. And we went last year on a vacation. We went off to the Bahamas. And when we went off to the Bahamas, my brother had suggested a certain island where nothing goes on so we could rest. And we went to that island, and I want to tell you, nothing goes on. I mean, he was right when he said we could relax there. So we went to this island. We got there. It was a long, skinny island like this. And the hotel we were in, if you could call it a hotel, was sitting here in the middle, right here. There were two things to do on that island. You could walk to the right or you could walk to the left. Once you'd done both of them, there was nothing else left to do. Everybody on that island was extremely phlegmatic. All the natives. Mañana was soon enough for everybody. Nobody needed to do anything. Nobody needed to go anywhere. Nobody was in a hurry. Where were you going? There was nothing to do anyway. If you got your job done, you had just more nothing to do. So consequently, there was no reason to get moved on anything at all. The first morning we were there, and this is the truth, we ordered breakfast from this little native waitress, Mazina Higgs. I'll never forget her. That was her name, Mazina Higgs. I wrote to her for a while afterwards. She was a Christian of sorts. And Mazina came and took our order the first morning. And she went off to place the order. That's the last we ever saw, Mazina. And that's the truth. She never showed up with anything. My husband, having been in the restaurant business all his life, he got up, he went looking around, there was nobody around. He went into the kitchen, there was nobody in the kitchen. They'd all gone home. My husband, and this is the truth, my husband ended up, he cooked breakfast for the two of us in the hotel kitchen. Brought it in, served it to me. The next day, Mazina showed up all giggles. She said, you're the ones I forgot, aren't you? Little touch of sanguine in her phlegmatic. Now, that's the way the whole island functioned. Now, you put two cholerics on an island like that, and what have you got? Well, the second day we were there, Fred got out his melancholy pad of paper and pencil. He said, I think we better get this vacation organized. He started writing down. He said, now let's see. We're coming here to this island. We're here in the sun. We got to get some kind of a tan before we go back. Now, cholerics don't like a lot to lie around in the sun. But he said, we got to get a little tan. So anyway, he decided in the morning, since I get sunburned very easily, we will lie on the beach from 10 to 11. All right, now we'll have breakfast 9 to 10. We'll lie on the beach 10 to 11. Then 11 to 12, we'll walk to the left. 12 to 1, we'll have lunch. 1 to 2, we'll walk to the right. Then at 2 o'clock, since we came here to relax, at 2 o'clock we'll lie down and we'll relax and make ourselves relax for a while. We'll do that from 2 to 3. And then on vacations you should read. So 3 to 4 we'll read. Now you see, by the time we get to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we both all of a sudden realize what we were doing. Here were two cholerics, worn out from all the work we've been doing, needing a rest. And what are we doing? We're organizing the vacation to make sure we don't waste it. Heaven forbid a choleric should waste their vacation. Now you see, when a choleric, we haven't been married to each other, but when a choleric is married to a phlegmatic, which is the norm, the choleric's idea of a vacation is to climb a mountain or put a wing on the house. And what's the phlegmatic's idea of what to do on a vacation? Lie around in the sun. read a few books. So you see, even on vacations, we can't really get along very well together. So the choleric can't relax. They're too impetuous. They're constantly trying to jump into things without thinking. They enjoy controversy and argument. They love to fight with people just for sport. And they don't really mean anything by it, but they think it's really fun to do. My father used to do this when we would go to Christmas to my mother's family. We had one uncle who was a union leader. And so for months before Christmas, my father would search through the papers for any articles about corruption in unions. Give him good conversation for Christmas. And so we would go over, and my father would have all of this memorized so that when he got there, he could come up with these stories. And my mother, phlegmatic mother, scared to death that there was going to be a controversy, wanting to keep everything easy going and relaxed and cool and calm and collected. And so on the way over, she'd say to my father, "Now, Chappie, don't cause any problems this Christmas." And my father, in true choleric sanguine style, would say, "Me cause problems? Why, I'm just the nicest person you've ever come up with. I mean, you're not going to get any problems out of me." And all of us kids, the three of us sanguine cholerics, we'd be sitting here wondering what he was going to stir up this year. And so we'd get there, and of course, after dinner, when the women were doing the dishes, my father would go in with the men. And sooner or later, he would say, "Well, Ethan, I hear that the secretary treasurer of the Boilermakers Union has run off with the Sunshine Fund." At which point Ethan would say, "Well," and they'd start. See, well, pretty soon they'd all get fighting over union. And he would keep throwing in other facts to get people equally stirred up. And see, then he would withdraw and come over and stand in the doorway. And I can remember as we stood there together, he'd put his hand on my shoulder and he'd say, "It takes so little to get your mother's entire family all upset." And see, the choleric loves to stir up controversy. They won't give up when they're losing. They keep going on. They come on too strong. They're quite inflexible, not very complimentary. Why give compliments? It wastes time. They dislike tears and emotions, and they're unsympathetic. Now, as workers, they've got little tolerance for the mistakes of the dummies of the world, and they can hardly put up with them at all. They don't analyze details. It isn't worth. If you have to read directions, it's not worth doing at all. That's the way most cholerics feel. And if all else fails, they read the directions. If a choleric man, he'll drive 40 miles into the desert before he'll admit that his wife was right when she said to turn left at Tucumcari. So they're not going to look at the directions. They're not going to listen to anybody at all. They're bored by the trivia. They don't want to bother with the trivia. They may make rash decisions because they're going to make it right now and not waste any time thinking about it. They may be rude and they may be tactless with other people. They don't think they're rude and tactless. What does the choleric think they're doing when they say something unkind to someone? They're just being honest, right? They pride themselves on their honesty. Everybody knows where they stand with me. They do and they hate it, but see, you don't see that part of it. You say, "Well, I lay it on the line. I make it clear. I don't mince any words." Anytime you cholerics hear yourself saying any of those things, you may think that's a virtue, but how many of you like to have it laid on the line about you? Not many of us. I find that in counseling, even people who come and ask for advice don't want it. So consequently, those who didn't ask for it surely don't want it. So be careful on what kind of advice you dole out, laying it on the line, letting them know where they stand, telling them what's wrong with them for their own good. Now see, not too many of us want to be told anything for our own good. So they are often rude and tactless, even though they feel that it's honesty. They manipulate people. They're very demanding of others. You do it my way and you do it now. And they feel that the end justifies the means. If it turns out right in the end, then it doesn't matter how many people I killed along the line. That doesn't make any difference. Most politicians have that particular aim in mind. As long as I win, who cares what I had to do to get there? The end justifies the means. We talked with one man in the East, and he came to me and he told me about this daughter he had. He said, "I've got this mixed-up daughter." She said every afternoon she comes home, she goes into her room, shuts the door, and she doesn't communicate with any of us. She doesn't come out till dinner time. Now, that made us sound kind of strange. And he said, "I don't know what's wrong with her, but she's locked up in her room all the time." So then I asked the wife, because he didn't seem to have any reasons about it. And I said, "Why does your daughter lock herself up in the room?" She said to me, "If you had to live with him, you'd lock yourself up in a room, too." So I found I really uncovered a problem here. So I could tell from her animosity there was something wrong. And I said, "Well," and I backed up a bit and said, "Well, what's the problem?" She said, "Well, he decided that he was going to lower our fuel bill." And this is in New England where the fuel bills are very high in the winter. Because he decided he was going to lower the fuel bill. So he's a physics professor and he brought home all of his wind tunnel equipment, set it up in the living room, and he found out that the biggest draft was coming in from the front door. So he nailed it shut for the winter and got that pink asbestos stuff, kind of fluffy stuff. And he nailed it all up to the front door so that when you drove up to the house, you saw this fluffy pink door. Then he found out that the back door let in draft, so he nailed that shut. The only way to get into the house was through the garage. That was the only door he left. Then he nailed that aluminum stuff over all the windows, so it was like a pit inside the house. But he was going to do this to cut out any drafts at all. Then he bought a lockbox for the thermostat and put that on that, and he was the only one with the key, and he set it at 58. Now, you know why he had this peculiar daughter? She'd taken her money and she'd bought herself an electric blanket. And every afternoon when she came home, she went into her room, locked the door, and wrapped herself in the electric blanket to do her homework. Now, you see, when you got both sides of this, the daughter wasn't so peculiar at all. In fact, I felt she was quite creative. So I went back to the man, and I tried to explain to him what the problem was here that he'd created. And do you know that he was so choleric that he kept saying to me, no matter what I pointed out about the way the family felt about him and what he was doing to them all, no matter what I pointed out to him, he kept saying to me, but I lowered the fuel bill. Now, you see, he had set a goal, and he had achieved the goal. And it didn't matter to him that everybody in the family hated him and that they would have thrown him out if there was any way to pay the rent. And no one could stand him at all. But you see, none of that bothered him because he had achieved his goal. The end justifies the means. And many times, the choleric doesn't care how many people they've hurt along the line as long as they ended up with what they wanted. Work may become his god. Many times, a choleric is only interested in work. They demand loyalty in the ranks. You're going to do it my way now, and if you don't do it, you can get out, pick up your paycheck, and go home. As a friend, they tend to use people. They tend to manipulate them. Talked with one of you this noon, has an 8-year-old son who is manipulating others and working to get people to do the things he wants. You see, they can manipulate from a very young age, and we have to be very cautious of that and watch out that that does not become an established pattern in their life. They dominate other people and decide for others. Had one lady come up, and she told me she'd gone to Europe with 3 phlegmatic friends. And she said it was lucky they had me because she said they never could have gotten around without me. She said, I had to tell them every night, now tomorrow morning we'll meet in the lobby at 7:29. The bus leaves at 7:30. Have on your walking shoes. We're going to tour Windsor Castle. Be sure that you bring a lunch because there won't be any time to stop. And we're going to do this, 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 and that. We'll be back in the hotel by 4:30. You'll have a half an hour to go to your room and rest and change. Be back in the lobby by 5. We're going to go out on the nightclub tour tonight. Now, she said, I had to lay it out for them. They never could have figured it out for themselves. She said, if it were not for me, they would be standing in Piccadilly Circus today. But, she said, the thing that's bothered me is that ever since we got home, not one of them has called me up. Now, see, here were 3 phlegmatic women that, according to her, would still be standing in England if she hadn't personally gotten them to the plane. They never could have made it without her. But once they got home and each one of those women thought about that tour of Europe with her, what did they decide? If they never saw her again, it would be too soon. Now, you see, a lot of cholerics, we take control of everything. We think we're the savior of the world. We're going to go in and straighten it out. In fact, one of you told me that you're what was your term? A rescuer, she said. That she realized now that this is a choleric trait, that she's a rescuer. When she sees people in need or with problems, she steps right in and takes care of it. I see, that's a real choleric trait. We're rescuing all the poor drowning people of life, and we're going to save them. But it's quite possible that most of them wouldn't drown at all if we let them alone. And they might like us a lot better if we let them struggle a bit and didn't jump right in and do it for them. Many times, choleric parents bring up incompetent children. And these children might even be bright, and they might even be cholerics themselves. But when they live under choleric parents, they tend to end up being unable to do anything. Why? Because the choleric parent has always done it first, better, stronger, sharper. And what has the child learned to do? Step back and let mother do it. Don't get in her way. Step back and let her do it. And you bring up a child who, when he's in your position in life, married and looking around, wonders, what in the world am I going to do and how would I get into this mess and how am I going to handle it? Because I've never had to handle anything but myself at all. So many times the choleric so over-dominates that the people under them have no chance of learning anything at all on their own because we're rescuing them all the time. They know everything. They can do everything better. They're too independent. I don't need you. I can do it by myself. They are possessive of their friends and mate. They constantly want to know where you are, what you're doing. A choleric husband calls you up 2 or 3 times a day to see what you're doing. They can't say, I'm sorry. Just sticks in their throat. They just can't say it. I had a young choleric boy who moved in with me at one time among the many people that have moved in with me. And he lived with me at no room and board. He was just there. And one morning he got up and I did not have the kind of breakfast cereal he wanted. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I don't like this. And he slammed down the kind that was there and he took off. Now, I felt he was lucky he had any breakfast cereal. My young melancholy son, very sensitive to other people's needs, and knowing the temperaments, and he came up to me after Richard had left, and he said to me, Mother, I want to say I'm sorry for Richard, because I know he's a choleric, and he won't be able to say it. You see, he sensed how Richard had hurt me. Richard didn't sense it at all. And the closest Richard ever came to apologizing was when he moved out, he said to me on the last day, He said, it's been fun being with you, and I feel bad about that one problem that we had together. Now, see, that's the closest Richard could come to saying he was sorry for yelling at me because I didn't have the right kind of breakfast cereal at a certain time. You see, it's very difficult for a choleric to say, I'm sorry. And then most important here, you cholerics, you may be right, but that's not necessarily very popular. So think about it. You can be right and have everybody hate you for it. It's most important that the choleric realize that their strength and their know-it-all attitude can be very, very difficult to live with or to work with. And now for the cute, trivial, little, inconsequential weaknesses of the sanguine. Can whip through these very fast because they don't amount to much. As the sanguine has trivial strengths, they have trivial weaknesses. Now see, we've seen the phlegmatic low-key strengths, low-key weaknesses. Seen the melancholy deep strengths, deep weaknesses. Seen the choleric loud, strong strengths, loud, strong weaknesses. And now we see the sanguine, cute little strengths, cute little weaknesses. Same thing. All right, when you look at these, the first thing is that they become compulsive talkers. Now, not many of us, but some of us are compulsive talkers. Some of us just don't know when to shut up, and we want to go on and on and on and say everything that we've got. In fact, my agent said to me one day, he said, you give too much when you're speaking. He says, you ought to leave them knowing that there is something left in your head you didn't say today. I had to think about that. So there is something left in my head, not a lot, but a little bit. So they become compulsive talkers. They exaggerate and elaborate on everything. They can never give anything, just the plain facts. When I was first married, my husband said to me, do you realize that you are constantly lying about everything? Now, as a sanguine, I do not lie about anything. What is it I do? I just exaggerate it, color it up a little to make it better than I heard it. I mean, I feel if somebody tells me a perfectly dreary story and I feel led to pass it on, what should I do first? Fix it up so it's not as dull to you as the way I heard it. It's important that we do that. So we exaggerate and elaborate. My friend Patty, the one with the eyelashes, I went over to her house once when she was just moving in, and I walked in the door and she said to me, every dog and cat on this street is dying of mange. Now that's a real gripper, isn't it, right on? You say that especially to another sanguine. And what's a sanguine picture? All these carcasses up and down the sidewalk, gasping their last breath right there. I looked at her melancholy daughter, shaking her head. I said, what's the truth? She said, the lady next door has a sick cat. But that doesn't get your attention. But every dog and cat on the street is dying of mange. I don't even think you can die of mange, but whatever. You see, it's a real opener. It really catches your attention. Exaggerate and elaborate. The sanguine also dwells on the trivia. Now, the sanguine cannot make just a simple statement of fact. There is no simple statement of fact for the sanguine. Now, a melancholy can say, Mary and I went to the store. Now, that's simple. You ask them, where have you been? Mary and I went to the store. You ask the sanguine, where have you been? What's the sanguine have to say? Mary, you know Mary, don't you? You don't know Mary? Mary's that friend of mine, the one kind of hippie. Never looks too put together. She comes to the Bible study with me. Remember? She's the one who never wears stockings. And just always has those flappy shoes on. Kind of, she's got that teenage son with acne. Kind of buck teeth, braces. You don't know him? He works down at that filling station. The filling station that's across the street from the school. You know the school down on the corner has the bushes out front with the pink flowers on it? That one there? See, well, by now you've totally lost track of that you're even talking about Mary. Now, see, this is the way the sanguine goes. Yeah, it's a cute little weakness, isn't it? In effect, a cute little weakness. I don't even really think it's a weakness, but my husband says it is. I went in one day when my daughter and I were out looking for houses. She was going to buy a house, and we were out together looking for houses, and we went to see all these terrible houses, and they were just awful. And I went into my husband's office at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a business day, and not being sensitive to his melancholy needs and schedule, and I went charging in because I had some interesting stories to tell him. Now, see, this is the problem. You put a sanguine and melancholy together. Melancholy's got a schedule. He didn't want to see me. And I got a lot of stories. I need to see him. And so I go barging in all happy. He should be thrilled to see me, right? You get anybody as bright as me dropping in the middle of the afternoon, you should be thrilled. So I come in there and I start telling him. I said, oh, you won't believe these houses we saw this afternoon. They're the worst things I ever saw in my whole life. And I start telling him all the details of all the houses. One of them upstairs that had 6 dolls where they kind of shoved the kids in. And had like little booths in there. And they had little bookshelves on the side. And I'm going on telling him all that the bushes were overgrown. Everything was terrible. The house was green. They were asking so much money for it. It was awful. So my husband, being melancholy, he asked me one simple question. Did they buy a house? Now, you see, if I answer that yes or no, What's that do to my stories? They're gone, because she didn't buy a house. So I try to avoid that question. And I say, well, Fred, the second house, he says, did they buy a house? Well, no, they didn't. If they didn't buy a house, then I don't need to hear the description of all the houses they didn't buy. Now, that was very deflating to me, because I had this whole roster. I mean, I could have gone on a week about all these terrible houses that we saw. But you see, Fred didn't want to hear them. So we tend to dwell on the trivia. We can't remember people's names. Now, why is it? It isn't that we're less intelligent than others. Why can't the Sanguine remember anybody's names? They never listened to it when you said it. Besides that, they frankly don't care who you are. You put those two together and it's impossible to remember a name. You didn't hear it, you don't care. Now, the Sanguine only cares that you know who they are. I mean, that's important, but they really don't care who you are at all. So they can't remember. They scare people off. They're too happy for some. They got all this restless energy that bouncing around makes people nervous. They're a little egotistical. They always want to look at me, look at me, look at me. And not everybody wants to look at you. They constantly are complaining, kind of muttering, blustering, and complaining. Now, I don't feel it's complaining. I just feel that it's once in a while we talk so much that some of it's bound to be a little negative. But it's not really complaining. You know, I don't like to make the beds. Why make it? We only get in it again. Why bother making the dishes, washing the dishes? I hate to make supper. He won't come home on time anyway. And just go around blustering this way. Now, I just feel it's part of our conversation, but Fred says that's negative, so I threw it in. Some sanguines have a loud voice and laugh too much. Some of us are controlled by our circumstances. A good day, we're thrilled. A bad day, we're miserable. Miserable, dramatic miserable. I mean, never deep miserable, just dramatic miserable. And you can explain, oh, how what wonderful stories we have of miseries. And we tell them all excited, oh, this was so terrible. You won't believe how awful this was. And that's the kind of way we want. So it's either the greatest or the worst, never anywhere in the middle. And always for the effect, not for the heart of the story, but for the effect that it will create as you're giving it. They get angry easily if things don't go their way, bang, scream, yell, have a tantrum. They seem phony to some people because they seem so much out front and really not much substance, and they never do grow up. Now, as workers, they'd rather talk than work. They forget their obligations. They don't exactly know what they're doing, and if you buy your Easter cards early, by the time Easter comes around, what's happened? You lost them or forgotten it's even Easter. I just did that. In fact, I just bought Mother's Day cards the other day, and I'm just hopeful that I'll know where they are on Mother's Day. In fact, I did get a file, and I don't have a file folder mentality, I've learned. I just can't think in folders. They're all manila, and that's hard, right? If they were different colors, I could handle it, I think. But just all the same, it's difficult for a Sanguine to see. And so I did buy one of these files that has months in it. And so I've actually put the Mother's Day cards into, what is it, May? Yeah, May 10th. Yeah. And so I've got it into May. Now, the big hope is that what? That I remember to look in there in May. And so we'll see what happens. But you see, the Sanguine sometimes gets a little mixed up on some of these things. And when they try to get too organized, it gets them more bogged down. And so it's better to just wing it and hope you remember the day before Mother's Day instead of doing so much far thinking that you lose them and then spend the money. In fact, I have a grandfather's card, and he died first. Now, that's bad. See, so that one I wasted. I shouldn't have bought that so far ahead, because by the time the day came, he was gone. The Sanguine's confidence fades fast because if people aren't watching them, they stop working. And they're undisciplined and their priorities are out of order. The Sanguine feels they do what's fun first, and then if there's any time left over, and they hope that the world comes to an end, before they really have to do the things they don't like to do. They decide by their feelings. That's how I feel about it. And they're very easily distracted. A Sanguine can walk from the kitchen to the garage and pass the dog and lose track of what they were going after. They waste a lot of time talking, and they hate to be alone. And if the Sanguine ever does decide to stay home today and clean the house, should they decide that, and they start doing it, after the first 10 minutes, what do they decide? This is too lonely. This is not for me. I will call up somebody to come and watch me work. And then when they come and watch you work, that isn't too good either, and so you end up doing what? Going out and forgetting the whole idea. So they hate to be alone. They need to be center stage. Anywhere they are, they manage to draw the attention to them, and they will pull it away from somebody. And they want to be popular, and they'll do whatever it takes to make people like them. They're always looking for credit. Come and look and see how wonderful I am, what great things I've done. And they dominate all conversations because they interrupt a lot, don't listen. Now, why is this? Where the choleric doesn't think they're bossy, they're just helping you. The Sanguine doesn't think they're interrupting. What do they think they're doing? That they're bailing out a dull conversation. It's not that they're interrupting, it's just that all of you must be bored with this dull story that Sally's telling over here. And because it is so dreary, then what am I doing here? I am helping the rest of you by coming in with a charming story that is absolutely going to entertain you. And you'll be so glad that I stepped in. Now, see, that's the way the Sanguine feels. They don't think they interrupt it. Now, the Sanguine also doesn't listen. Now, they think they listened. They think they did because they had their mouth shut for 2 or 3 seconds. But what is the Sanguine doing when their mouth is shut? Planning up the next plan of attack, you see. And so they're getting ready to jump out. They are giving answers for everybody else. And my husband put a terrible rule into our family that only the person asked the question is allowed to answer it. Now, that has curbed a lot of the conversation. Because Marita and I always answered for everybody. Didn't make any difference who was asked the question, we'd answer. And while our answers weren't necessarily always right, they were fun. And they were much better than the truth would have been had anyone listened to it. So consequently, we thought this was the way to go. They're fickle and forgetful. They're your friend today, and they forget to show up tomorrow. And they make a lot of excuses about why they didn't do anything. And they tend to repeat the story. If it plays well on Sunday, what do? We'll run it for the rest of the week. Because we figure it got a good laugh then, we're going to keep going with it.